This is the lecture tape for March 3rd, 1999. We're continuing on with a legal system, Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 9 through chapter 26. This is the conclusion now of Moses' second message, and he began that in our chapter 6, and it concludes now today with chapter 26. In the first section, he talked about love and obeying God. He said God reached out in love to Israel and took them from all the nations of the earth, and that they were to respond to that love in return by loving him and obeying him. Also involved in that obedience is worship of him. The second section we studied went into the fact that God says his people were to worship him at only one location, the location to which he would choose, not like the pagans who would worship at every hill or wherever they decided to. He also reminded them of the festivals that they were to keep, and then he said three of them, Passover, weeks, and booths, were to be celebrated at the central sanctuary that he would choose. And finally, last week and then concluding with this week, was the application of the covenant laws. So we're continuing on then with the legal system here. So the best way is probably just to break it down paragraph by paragraph. So looking at chapter 23, verses 9 to 14, we come to the issue of sanitation in the camp. Remembering again that this is a holy war, God has called Israel to go in and judge the Canaanite nations. He is directing, he is leading, and he is fighting. He is simply saying that he resides there with them. And as such, he can only remain if the people and the campsite remain holy. So basically, he's saying they need to dig their latrines and use the outer areas of camp for that rather than do that right in the central camp so that God could remain with them. Verses 15 and 16 deal with the issue of runaway slaves. We've already seen slaves within Israel. They became slaves either because they sold themselves or their children or for a debt payback, and that was a maximum of 6 years because on the seventh year they were released. If they were a slave any longer than that, it was because of their choice. The runaway slave issue deals with slaves in surrounding nations. They were very cruel to their slaves, and they would run away and try to come into Israel to escape their masters. The Hittites and the Egyptians actually set bounties upon runaway slaves' heads of 2 shekels, and to harbor a slave, a runaway slave, was a capital offense. But God says in Israel, if a runaway slave came to you, they were to protect and to house that slave. He was assuming, too, that they would come in and embrace the Israelite lifestyle and become true worshipers of Yahweh. Verses 17 and 18 deal with money that was to be brought to the temple for worship. In this case, it's what is not acceptable. The Canaanites used prostitutes to earn money for the temple. In fact, women in various communities would be hired out as temple prostitutes, and then their money would be brought before the gods or goddesses there. God says that his people were not to do that. And he ties it to the issue of vows. Now, when a woman made a vow, if it had any monetary amount attached to it, she had no way of earning that money. God says it's unacceptable for you to hire yourself as a prostitute and then bring money earned as a prostitute to pay off your vow. He also referred that to dogs, if you're in the King James Version, or male prostitutes in the other version. It didn't matter whether they were a female or male. They were not to hire themselves as prostitutes and then think they could bring that money before God. He says it is detestable, and he detests them both the act of prostitution and any money gained from it. Verses 19 and 20 deal with interest on loans. He says, when you loan to your brother, you may not charge interest, but you may to a foreigner. If a brother needed a loan, it was not for a frivolous reason. It was because he needed it to survive. God says you are to open your hands and loan to him liberally, but you must do so without taking advantage of him. There's documentation that in 1500 BC, the interest rate went as high as 50%. So you can see if they were already hurting to begin with and needed a loan just to survive, 50% interest would essentially put them into slavery. He continues on with the issues of vows in 21 to 23. He said, vows are okay, but just make sure you plan on carry them out, because when you take a vow in the name of the Lord, you are asking him to be a witness to that vow, calling him in as part of the legal contract. And if you do that, then you must pay the vow quickly, not be slow in doing that. Otherwise, God will judge you and consider it a sin because you said it and you didn't fulfill it. It's another way that God is reminding his people that what they say with their mouth or what they agree with their mouth is serious, and they must keep and honor their word. 24 and 25 goes into hand gleaning and deals with widows and travelers. If you were traveling, say, for a festival, and you had to travel several days and couldn't bring enough food to go both directions, it was acceptable for you to stop by a field and to get enough food in your hands for that one meal, but it was unacceptable for you to go in and harvest it and take more than you needed just to survive that one meal. Again, that was God's way of protecting his people. Chapter 24 deals with dignity of the individual, and it begins with the issue of divorce. Divorce was already common at this time, and it's really nice because Jesus in Mark 10:5 comments on why Moses said what he did in this section of Deuteronomy. He's saying that God allowed Moses to say this because their hearts were hard. He's not saying that God initiated or gave divorce, only that he allowed it. So what Moses does in this section is sets down some rules or some guidelines. He says a man can't divorce his wife like the pagans do just for any reason, like she burnt the toast. But there had to be found something indecent about her. Now, what that was is very difficult to say, because if it was something serious like adultery, she would have been stoned to death. So there's no indication of what something indecent would actually be. The commentaries took certain guidelines from other cultures around them that they used as legal means for divorce, and I'll include those, but I don't know whether that was part of Israel's something indecent or not. The first one was if a wife neglected her household duties by going into business. The second was if the wife deserted her husband, and the third was if the wife failed to produce children. Each one of these three areas was acceptable reason for divorce in the nations around them. Whether or not this was considered indecent in Israel, I don't know. Moses goes on and says it can't be hasty word of mouth like the neighbors do, but it had to be a proper legal matter, in which case a bill of divorce was issued. Elders of the town were to decide the case. There was to be testimonies, witnesses, the whole thing. If the divorce is issued, which was always on the husband's initiation, quite often it was evident that it wasn't the wife's fault, in which case she was given certain rights. Her husband could not send her away empty-handed. He had to do one of three things. She was allowed to keep her bride price. And if you recall, the bride price is 50 shekels. That was the average. Sometimes it was more than that. And just so that you get a picture of how much that was, if they cashed in everything that they earned during a year, it would come out to about 10 shekels. So about 5 years' wages was the bride price. So if he divorced her, he would either have to give her back her bride price or give her back her dowry. And the dowry, you remember, was clothing and household goods, and sometimes in the wealthy cases, it included slaves. And the third one was that she could receive an inheritance from her ex-husband as a new dowry. So he couldn't send her empty-handed. He had to do one of three things for her. And the last point was that she was issued a bill of divorce. What that did was legally allowed her to remarry, just as if her first husband had died. Now, it's interesting because verse 4 says, her first husband who divorced her is not allowed to marry her again after she has been defiled. Now, this defiled is a very unusual form of a Hebrew verb, and I believe it's only used in this section of Scripture. And it makes it clear that the woman is a victim, not the guilty party, and she has been forced to declare herself unclean by her first husband. And another man has found her to be clean and has married her. And what God says is the first husband can't come in now and exert pressure on her to come back to him, because that will destroy the second marriage. And so what he's done is completely forbid her from returning to the first marriage. So if he sends her away, he can't ever have her back again. So he better make sure that that's exactly what he really wants, because in this case, she is forced to comply with his wishes. This was also in reaction to what was happening in Egypt at the time, which was wife swapping. And I grew up in the 60s, and that was a common practice in the 60s, or among certain people, and I thought it was really, really strange. But here we find it all the way back prior to Deuteronomy, because Moses is saying that that's not acceptable. Well, continuing on in 24:5, we find the newlyweds, and this continues with our warfare exemption. Last week we talked about this. If a man was engaged and not married for the first year, which would put it about a two-year span, he was to be exempt from war. And during that time, he was to establish his marriage, his household, and generally produce an heir. And we find that he was also to bring happiness to his wife. God says this family is so important, you need to spend time building that relationship in the beginning. He was also not to have any other duty laid on him. Again, this was just so that he could concentrate on that new marriage and get a good, strong foundation that would carry them through the rest of their life. If he was to leave prior to that time, chances are, if he was killed in battle, he would leave a young wife, possibly even a pregnant wife, destitute. Verse 6 deals with millstones. It says, do not take a pair of millstones, not even the upper one, as security for a debt, because that would take a man's livelihood as security. Now, millstones are two stones. The bottom one weighs 100 or more pounds, and we've seen them all in pictures. They were generally black basalt, and they were a huge flat bottom bowl, and they had either straight or slightly curved sides, and grain would be put inside there, and then a smaller millstone that was 4 to 5 pounds and shaped to the person's hand who's doing the grinding would then be rolled around the top of that grain inside the bigger millstone, and that would actually crush it into flour so that they could produce bread. God says that was not to be taken as security for any kind of debt, because the man could not live without that. His family needed that in order to survive. Verse 7 deals with kidnapping. It was against the law to kidnap an Israelite and sell him into slavery, and it was punishable by death. I wondered if maybe Moses was thinking about the 12 tribes and the fact that the brothers had sold Joseph into slavery. Verses 8 and 9 deal with leprosy. Now, any skin disease could be called leprosy. So what Moses is doing is reinforcing Leviticus 13 that says the priests have all of God's laws, and they will determine whether or not this is truly leprosy or something else, and just reminding them to do everything that the priests instructed them to do. Verses 10 to 15 deal with pledges and wages. It was common when they took a loan to use crops, lands, or items from their homes as collateral. And God says in order to preserve their dignity and the sanctity of the home, the creditor can't go into a debtor's home and take out the item. The person who's taken out the loan has to be allowed the dignity to present that item to him. Also, it says if you have somebody working for you on a daily basis, you are to pay him at the end of the day his wages, because he depends upon that to purchase food so that he can survive and come back another day to serve you. Failure to do either of these is considered a serious sin of neglect and is unacceptable to the Lord. Verse 16 says, fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor children be put to death for their fathers. Each must die for his own sin. This is in reaction to a practice where if a worker accidentally kills the son of the employee, that the worker's son would then be taken as punishment and put to death. God says that's unacceptable. My laws are very clear. If you're responsible for a death, you follow my laws. Don't go for anybody else within the family. Now you might go, now wait a minute. When we were in Exodus and Deuteronomy, we saw whole families wiped out because of the sins of a father. That was different. When they were in the wilderness, those sins were directly against God and were punishable by God. So this is man to man, and the other one was man to God. So it's a whole different ball game, and you can't mix the two of them. Verses 17 and 18 deal with a protected class of people, which are the widows, the orphans, and the aliens. These people had no way of supporting themselves, and God said they had three basic human rights. They had the right to justice, clothing, and food. And God says, because I have provided you with this land and these crops, I expect you to take care of their needs. And he talked about not double gleaning their fields so that there was food left so that these people could come in and take their own mini harvest. And we're going to get into this much more when we get into the book of Ruth. Chapter 25 deals with individual rights, and it begins with the punishment of flogging. And we're going to come to see that both men and women were flogged for various crimes, and the lashes ranged anywhere from 20 to 60. Moses set down guidelines on this now. He says, first off, it's to be done solemnly. You're never supposed to come and do this in anger or resentment. And Jewish tradition has that while these lashes were being administered, the chief justice of the court was actually reading passages of Deuteronomy out loud to the people witnessing, to the one administering, and to the one receiving the lashes. And he actually ends with the words, yet he was merciful. He atoned for their iniquities, and he did not destroy them. Now, the greater the crime, the more lashes they received. But God said it was not to exceed 40 lashes. We're going to find that by the time they get to 2 Corinthians, they're actually only doing 39 lashes because they were so afraid of miscounting and going above the 40 lashes that they felt it was better to go one less. God set that down because most people that received 40 to 60 lashes died. And so rather than just a flogging and a punishment, it actually became a death sentence by flogging. Verse 4 says, do not muzzle an ox while it is treading out the grain. Now we hear of this a lot, particularly in the New Testament. What God is saying is the oxen were there to help the farmer. The grain was harvested that was put on a thrashing floor, which is a hard clay floor. And then the oxen with a heavy sled would be trampling over it to separate the wheat from the hull. And he says, the oxen is doing work for you, but he doesn't receive wages, and you are to provide for him. So allowing him to eat some of the grain as he's working it through is actually his wages. Because he's working for you, providing for you, you must pay him wages. We'll also find that the farmers, most of them were poor and did not even own oxen. So they essentially were borrowing those or hiring them from other neighbors who received a monetary wage. So the only benefit the oxen actually received was what they ate while they were doing the treading of the grain. 25 verses 5 to 10 then deals with what's called a levirate marriage. When a widow was without a son, she was also without security. So God made a provision to protect these young widows, but it was also a way of preserving the name of the deceased husband. If he did not have a son, his name would disappear, or his line would disappear from the tribes of Israel. So it was kind of a dual protection. This is an ancient custom that was actually taking place all the way back in Genesis. You saw that in your homework today with Judah. Now, it assumes that the man died young and that his widow is still of childbearing age but has not produced a child yet. The law said that she was not to marry outside of the family unless the relatives refused to marry her. Now, if you think back to the video series we saw, when a couple married, the wife left her family and came to the husband's family home where they had built on a home next to the parents. And so she has essentially left her family to come there. And so the law says that she should not go outside that family, but should remain within there. And that the next brother the closest relative to her should marry her out of respect for her because she has left her family to join theirs, and also out of respect for his deceased brother. It was the nearest relative who was to marry her, but if for some reason that didn't work, she could go to another relative. But she did have rights. She could refuse to marry the nearest relative, in which case it would become a public ceremony and she would suffer public humiliation, be labeled as uncooperative, but she would be released and she could marry someone else. Or the relatives could refuse to marry her. Look at verse 7. If the man does not want to marry his brother's wife, she shall go to the elders at the town gate and say, "My husband's brother refused to carry on his brother's name in Israel. He will not fulfill the duty of the brother-in-law to me." Then the elder of his town shall summon him and talk to him. If he persists in saying, "I do not want to marry her," his brother's widow shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, take off one of his sandals, spit in his face, and say, "This is what is done to the man who will not build up his brother's family line. That man's line shall be known in Israel as the family of the unsandaled." Now there's a couple issues in here we need to discuss to understand this clearly. First is the elders at the town gate. When they're in cities, the gates or the city walls are between 10, 15, 20, 30 feet thick. What that is there's a wall with a room or multiple rooms and then an inner wall. And in these rooms, the elders sit and carry out the business of the city. When legal proceedings need to be taken care of, they go to the city gate where these elders are sitting and they're already assembled. Essentially, the court is already there. So what they're saying is if he doesn't do this, she goes to court. She goes to the elders. The removing of the sandal is very interesting because the sandal was a legal proceeding and it was like a deed of land. Land was bought and sold according to how far one could walk in a certain specific period of time. He could walk for an hour, a day, a week, a month. And as he walked, he would walk half of the time and then put a boundary stone and then come back again. And it was actually a triangular shape. It wasn't a square. So if he was walking for an hour, he wouldn't have to go 15 minutes this direction, then 15, 15, and 15 back. He could go actually, 25 minutes one way, put the stone, and then 25 the other, and just cross it off at the bottom. So if she takes his sandal off, what she is saying is that you have removed any future of administering my husband's property or his estate. You have chosen by not marrying me to relinquish this land that he owned. Now the question comes up, what if he's already married? Well, it doesn't make any difference. That's where you come in with the multiple wives sometimes and the unloved wife. The first husband that she produces becomes the heir to her deceased husband. Any other heirs then become, or any other children become, the sons and daughters of the one who married her, which is actually called the kinsman redeemer. The problem doesn't come in so much with somebody that already has a wife, because he probably already has an heir, but it comes in with one who has not been married, because the first son he produces with her actually becomes his brother's heir, and so he has to produce more than one son that will become his own heir. Verses 11 and 12 deal with a violent fight. The covenant anticipates a time when the woman might intervene during a fight between her husband and another man, and if she reaches out and seizes the attacker by the testicles, she's to be punished, not based on the degree of the injury, but because she acted immodestly and dishonored her husband and herself. Again, this deals with the issue of heirs. If a man cannot produce heirs, his name will die because there's no redeemer for a man, only for a woman. But if a man is alive and he doesn't produce heirs, his name will die. The punishment was that her hand would be cut off. Now, this is another one of those like the rebellious sons where it's a law, but it doesn't seem to ever be enacted. At least there's no record of it in any of Israel's history. 13 to 16 deals with weights and measures. A society that doesn't have coins is dependent upon its scales. God says you can't have a light and a heavy stone, so that when you buy, you use the light stone, and when you sell, you use the heavy stone. He says when you do business, you're to do it honestly and fairly. 17 to 19 deal with the Amalekites. God says they're to blot the memory of the Amalekites out. And we've already talked about this in Exodus. They came against Israel when they were most defenseless, straight out of slavery. And they came from behind and attacked the weak and the sick. And so God said that they were to be wiped out. Now the Amalekites at that were living in the Sinai Peninsula, but they also live in the Negev and the Transjordan. So we're going to find them coming against Israel quite often. And 400 years after the original attack, God commands King Saul to wipe them out, and he does not. So, consequently, God rejects King Saul. Chapter 26 deals with the festival of the first fruits. Again, this is another reminder of Israel that they are in the land that God had promised, and as such, they were to bring the first fruits before the Lord at the central location. Why does God say that? Because there was a tendency for them to believe that their God, Yahweh, was a desert God. And now that they were in the land, Baal is the god of fertility, so maybe they should bring their gifts before Baal. God says they are not to do this, that they are to bring their produce before the Lord at the central location, and recognition and acknowledgement that he is the giver of all good things. In fact, they recite their history. They start with, "My father was a wandering Aramean," saying that God started by calling Abraham, who lived in Aram Padam, and took him, and we wandered around, and we went down to Egypt, and then we wandered in the wilderness, and yet here we are, the fulfillment of the promise that God gave to our father Abraham. 12 to 15 deals with tithing. Again, they were to give 10% to the priests and Levites, and on the third year they were also to give to those in need. Again, God is reminding him that everything they have is a gift for him, and those that don't have are to be taken care of out of their abundance. Then Moses concludes his second message with verse 16. "The Lord your God commands you this day to follow these decrees and laws, carefully observing them with all your heart, with all your soul. You have declared this day that the Lord is your God, and that you will walk in his ways, and you will keep his decrees, commands, and laws, and that you will obey him. And the Lord has declared this day that you are his people, his treasured possession, as he promised, and that you are to keep all his commands. He has declared that he will set you in praise, fame, and honor high above all the nations he has made, and that you will be a people holy to the Lord your God, as he promised." These are then followed because God commanded them. It wasn't Moses that's saying that they have to command them. And because the covenant obliges them to keep them. So Moses is essentially reminding Israel that they are a covenant nation. They have made a covenant with God. He chose them out of love, and he's given them this covenant. And he has now set down his commands for them, of which Moses has just been giving to them again. And he says it's your choice whether or not you will obey these commands. He's going to go on in his next message to say, if you obey, these are the blessings. If you don't, these are the curses. And Israel, the choice is up to you. The same applies for you and I, because we are God's chosen people, chosen through Jesus Christ, who became our Savior and Lord, and we have the same choices to make. God has certain commands for us also, and whether we choose to obey them or not is a choice. And just as Israel, if we obey, we're blessed, and if we disobey, we receive the curses. And as we've learned, curses are consequences, some brought upon by natural consequences of the sin, others divinely brought about.